second case of the day, Dumanis v. Lewicki. Mr. Carroll.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Thomas Carroll on behalf of the appellants, Adam Swike, Richard Swike, and Derek Lewicki. This appeal comes to you after the entry of a default judgment by the district court in the amount of $413 million for assorted claims, including civil RICO and fraud. Now, the standard of review is in considering a default judgment based on discovery violations is abuse of discretion. And this was an abuse of discretion by the trial court. The abuse of discretion was twofold, really. The first legal point was that the district judge, Judge Bucklow, overturned the magistrate judge's entry of partial sanctions against some of the defendants in favor of harsher sanctions that included daily fines, and that ultimately led to the default judgment. Now, as Rule 72A of the federal rule states, a magistrate judge assigned to handle discovery in a case can only be overturned on the objection of a party to this entry or denial of sanctions based on a clear error standard. That means that the district judge must be left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. As this court has described it, the clear error standard must strike the court not simply as wrong, but as wrong with the force of a five-week-old, unrefrigerated, dead fish. Now, Judge Nolan was assigned to manage discovery in this case. She had the opportunity to craft orders regarding discovery and to consider the meaning of those orders. And yet that authority was essentially wrested away without an explanation of what clear error she had made during the course of handling discovery. Now, the first issue that was overturned by Judge Bucklow concerned the certain records from an HSBC Poland bank account belonging to Derek Lewicki. It was an abuse of discretion for Judge Bucklow to reverse Judge Nolan's finding that there were no sanctionable actions on the part of Derek Lewicki as it pertained to this account. Judge Nolan had ordered the production of certain records, including wire transfer confirmations, on January 12th of 2012. And after Mr. Lewicki produced some but not all of the records that had been sought by the plaintiffs moved for sanctions against him. Now, the judge said, Judge Nolan said, after carefully reviewing the record, the court finds that Lewicki has complied with its orders. She had no problem with these efforts. She had no problem with Mr. Lewicki's efforts, which is, included letters, including his account information to the bank, an affidavit concerning calls that he had made to the bank, which indicated that that he was simply unable to obtain those records. And there was evidence in, that the bank had closed in 2011, ceased doing operations for personal banking in Poland. Judge Bucklow reversed these the finding of no sanctions without really any tangible evidence to indicate that he had acted in bad faith or that he had disobeyed the court's orders. She seemingly acted on the notion that he was simply being dishonest. But as Judge Nolan observed, there was no evidence to put forth by the plaintiffs that these records are available, that they were available from HSBC Poland, or that Lewicki had not done any of the things he said he had done. Judge Nolan observed that plaintiffs who are seeking contempt must show by clear and convincing evidence that the court order has been violated, and that is the standard in this circuit. Now, this is a theme that runs throughout the course of this case and the course of this appeal. When the plaintiffs were presented with a burden to show that something had been done wrong, whether it was the burden to prove their case, the burden to show that that these records were in fact available and were being withheld, or later on that adverse evidence had been destroyed in order to warrant a showing of bad faith in the context of a hard drive that had been destroyed belonging to Richard Zweig, and then later in the context of the evidentiary hearing that was denied by Judge Bucklow for prove up of damages, there was simply no burden put on the plaintiffs at any point. It was always the same finger pointing at the defendants to say that they were liars and therefore they must be lying now, and that was, you know, it was just conclusory essentially. It was also an abuse of discretion to hold Adam Zweig in contempt and impose a daily fine when he had made a good faith showing of efforts to obtain his Julius Baer bank records in Switzerland. He had filed written requests for the bank, and the court found that those written requests were inadequate. Judge Nolan, in fact, found that those requests were inadequate and ordered that a sanction should enter requiring an adverse jury instruction. This is a harsh sanction. It's a typical sanction under these circumstances. Without defining the clear error that lay in those sanctions, Judge Bucklow reversed those sanctions and ordered daily fines and ultimately entered default based on his inability to produce those records. Now, he provided a letter that the plaintiffs conceded was substantially compliant with the court's requirements to address to Julius Baer Bank after Judge Bucklow entered her sanctions order, and yet that did not satisfy the court. Judge Bucklow described an exacting standard for showing impossibility, inability to comply with a discovery order. The standard has long been, since the 1950s, was announced in Society International versus Rogers. I won't embarrass myself with French pronunciation, but it describes good faith efforts as the standard for compliance with orders and discovery. And in this case, good faith was shown by the issuance of a letter by Mr. Zweig after the entry of a sanctions order that complied in all respects with the court's requirements. Now, the third issue was the destruction of a hard drive belonging to Richard Zweig, which contained some documents. 21 disks had been produced during the course of discovery that originated from that hard drive, many of which originated from that hard drive. There was no evidence of any kind, and this is really the central point regarding the hard drive. There was no evidence of any kind that adverse evidence had been destroyed by the defendants. There was no evidence to suggest, really, that any evidence had been destroyed other than the hard drive itself, which it was admitted had crashed in 2009, and the defendants provided documentation of an attempt to repair that hard drive. And then in 2010 had been allowed to be disassembled, essentially. Now, there's no question that the defendants had a duty to preserve that evidence. Judge Nolan and Judge Bucklow both found that to be the case, and we don't dispute that on appeal. However, that's a distinct issue from whether it was done in bad faith, and the standard for finding bad faith in the context of destroying evidence is the notion that something harmful to the party's case was destroyed. There was no evidence of that in this case. Judge Nolan entered an order that made sense in the context, a spoliation charge, which would have essentially given the finder of fact, the jury, the opportunity to assess any evidence, scant evidence of which had been put forth at that point, but any evidence that the plaintiffs could marshal in defense of the notion that adverse evidence had been destroyed. And she suggested an evidentiary hearing, in fact, in her lengthy opinion on the matter. Judge Bucklow very quickly overturned that, ordered the production of all relevant emails within 45 days, notwithstanding the fact that emails, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of emails on those 21 disks, while simultaneously barring the use of those 21 disks worth of information at trial. Now, there was never any explanation in her opinion, nor consideration of the notion that there would be no good reason for the defendants to have acknowledged the existence of this hard drive if they were attempting to hide the fact of its existence or to conceal evidence. The hard drive itself was not the subject of any discovery request. Documents are what is sought in discovery, and in this case, documents were produced from that hard drive. They disclosed the origin, the source of those documents, and there was no order entered concerning that hard drive until 2011, at which time everyone admits that the hard drive had been destroyed. Now, moving on, once default judgment was entered, and I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Michaels.
May it please the Court, Robert Michaels for plaintiffs' appellees. Your Honors, let me respond to some of the points that Mr. Carroll made this morning. First of all, the burden of proof to establish impossibility rests squarely with the defendants. Plaintiff's burden here was only to establish that a production order had not been complied with, and defendants acknowledged that a production order had not been complied with respect to both Mr. Lewicki's HSBC documents and the records from Adam Switch's undisclosed Julius Baer account. And when defendants argue, as they did below and as Judge Nolan effectively did as well, that plaintiffs needed to contact HSBC to demonstrate that wire transfer confirmations, standard banking records, were in fact available, they're improperly flipping that burden to the plaintiffs. Defendants and Mr. Lewicki, with respect to the HSBC documents, failed to meet that burden because all he submitted was an affidavit stating that he had supposedly contacted HSBC and was told that wire transfer confirmations were not available, which is an implausible statement on its face. Defendants' counsel had been specifically ordered by Judge Nolan to contact HSBC and confirm that Mr. Lewicki's production would be complete. Defendants' counsel flatly violated that order, submitted a declaration saying he did not contact HSBC because he didn't believe it was necessary. And tellingly, defendants' counsel had submitted that declaration shortly after he had contacted Julius Baer with respect to Adam Switch's account and confirmed, to the detriment of defendants, that account records would be available upon a written request. And Mr. Lewicki had, in addition, other than the affidavit and a couple of letters that he had stated he had sent to HSBC, he also had made multiple misrepresentations to the court concerning the HSBC account itself, including stating that a flyer from HSBC indicated that account records were, quote, subject to decreasing availability, when in fact the flyer was totally silent about the availability of account records. All other banks in this case had produced wire transfer confirmations upon request, and Mr. Lewicki also misrepresented the duration during which the account was open. He had concealed the existence of this account in response to plaintiff's discovery requests, as well as 9 other accounts that he either owned directly or were owned by entities that he controlled. He concealed the existence of 2 entities that he owned that he was required to disclose. And he had told, as I'll get to shortly, a flatly unbelievable story that even Judge Nolan found was unbelievable about his destruction of the hard drive. Judge Bucklow was perfectly correct to find that Judge Nolan's order, by finding that, by giving the burden to establish impossibility effectively to plaintiffs, and believing Mr. Lewicki in the context in which he made that statement, was clearly erroneous. With respect to Adam Switch's bank records, the adverse inference approach taken in Judge Nolan's bank record order was clearly erroneous. What Judge Nolan's order did is allow Adam Switch to produce the records from his Swiss bank account without any consequence at all, right up until the close of discovery. Only then would the jury be given an adverse inference. And defendants suggest an adverse inference instruction. Defendants suggest that this approach is some kind of hedge against the possibility that Adam might not be able to obtain the records. But Judge Nolan's order is clear that she believed the records were in fact available. She rejected the only excuse that Adam Switch had made for not producing the records, which was that the account had somehow belonged to his teenage son. So, and that's the problem with the adverse inference approach here. When records are found to be available and a party has acted in bad faith and violated multiple orders, as even Judge Nolan found Adam did with respect to the Swiss account, which again, he had failed to disclose, he had lied about the existence of it when he was initially confronted with records showing that transfers into the account, and then had said the account belonged to his teenage son, which Swiss law would have prohibited. When records are available and a party acts in bad faith, an adverse inference instruction is completely improper. It would allow all parties the choice of instruction or production right up to the close of discovery. Juries would be left to decide cases based on the evidence that parties thought was favorable to them and a series of generic instructions. Judges like Judge Nolan would spend all sorts of time deciding motions to compel only to have parties disregard them as a matter of strategy and say, you know what, I'll take the inference. That's okay. And parties would be able to exercise that choice right up to the close of discovery, depriving their opponents of the chance to use those exhibits and documents in depositions and to follow the evidentiary chain that those documents might create, which is particularly important here with respect to bank records. Now, in some cases, like the pension committee case that defendants cited, adverse inference approach is proper. There, like in all the cases they cited, the documents no longer existed. No litigant was given the strategic choice to withhold unfavorable documents. That's the problem with using that approach here, and that's why Judge Bucklow correctly reversed Judge Nolan's order. With respect to the hard drive, there was a similar legal error. Judge Nolan found that defendant's story about the circumstances under which the hard drive was destroyed was incredible. They had told the court that the hard drive had crashed in 2009 and was recovered from in certain documents, but not all documents, and that's critical, were recovered in 2010. But then defendants didn't disclose the existence of the hard drive or produce any documents from it until 2011, at which time their counsel said the documents were recovered from a hard drive, they're unavailable, quote, until now. Judge Nolan found that defendants' new story about the hard drive crashing in 2009 was incredible, particularly given that the hard drive production interspersed throughout the 21 disks contained documents from 2011 and 2010 and after they had said the hard drive crashed. Judge Nolan then found that even though their story was incredible, plaintiffs had failed to meet their burden to establish prejudice. But the error there is that, as this court found in the In re Thomas Consolidated Industries case, lying about a discovery abuse establishes bad faith. That's what happened here. And once bad faith is established, prejudice follows, as this court found in the Crabtree case. That's why it was impossible for us to know exactly what else was on that hard drive. All we knew is that defendants destroyed it in the midst of discovery. They had lied about the circumstances, as the court found, had lied about the circumstances of its destruction, and that they had admitted themselves. They had recovered some, but not all documents from the hard drive, and we had requested a forensic inspection. It was destroyed seemingly because of the later documents, after we had requested a forensic inspection. In those circumstances, bad faith and prejudice follow, and the kind of optional instruction that Judge Nolan had offered was legally improper and inadequate and clearly erroneous. I'd now like to address The limited inappropriate role of the Apollo number in plaintiff's damages calculation, which I think is the issue that I assume Mr. Carroll had wanted to address. Defendant's own conduct necessitated the use of that Apollo number. In using it, was actually very generous and helpful to the defendants. The Apollo number was used only to calculate an offset to plaintiff's gross damages. Plaintiff's gross damages were we took the Orco price that Orco was going to pay for the shares, all the shares of KBP, multiplied it by plaintiff's rightful ownership percentage of KBP. We got gross damages. But plaintiffs still owned their wrongly reduced minority shares of KBP. So it was only fair to deduct that value from our gross damages. How would we do that? Well, the logical way to do it would be to multiply our stated ownership percentages by the current value of KBP, which would normally be determined using a discounted cash flow analysis. But we couldn't perform a discounted cash flow analysis because defendants had refused to, in violation of Judge Rowland's court order, to produce the leases, financial statements, bank records, bank debt documents showing the value of KBP. Judge Rowland had specifically ordered Richard Switch, as a KBP officer, to produce those documents. He refused. We had sought them by two other means in two other requests. They refused to provide them to us. So our unrebutted expert concluded, in those circumstances, which was really like the circumstances in the BCS case here, where a defendant has impaired a damages calculation, broad latitude is afforded. Our unrebutted expert concluded, in these circumstances, let's use the last arm's-length offer for KBP, for all the shares of KBP, which was a net offer of $44.6 million made by international real estate firm Apollo. At no time did defendants who controlled all the information about KBP, so using that Apollo number would harm defendants if and only if KBP was now, in fact, worth more than $44.6 million. Defendants controlled all the information about KBP. At no time did they say, hey, you know what? The Apollo number understates KBP's value because we acquired new land. We built some new buildings. We renegotiated the bank debt. They never did any of that. In fact, the only time they addressed the value of KBP in this case was in response to our temporary restraining order motion, where they had said without a $200,000 capital increase, KBP faced an existential threat. And this is also in the record, Adam Switch had offered plaintiffs just under $1 million for their minority shares in KBP. By using the Apollo number.
By the way, what is an existential threat to a corporation? Is this something that Jean-Paul Sartre would write about?
That's a good question, Your Honor. That was
terminating a threat to its existence.
I believe that's what
different
they
meant. From an existential threat.
I believe that's what they meant. And without $200,000, the company might fail. And then Adam offered our clients $1 million total for their shares. And by using the Apollo number, we gave them credit for $10.6 million because we didn't adjust for the fact that our shares are powerless minority shares in a closely held company. So for those reasons, using the Apollo number was proper and actually very generous to defendants, and they never proposed any alternative way to handle the issue. Final issue I'd like to address is this. While it's proper here to consider the full gamut of defendants' discovery abuses. Abuses that are discussed in Judge Bucklow's default order were more than sufficient to warrant entry of default judgment. But as this Court's noted, it's also proper to consider not just the straw that broke the camel's back, but all the straws that the recalcitrant party piled on during the course of the litigation. Here, those straws unquestionably include the other abuses described in our brief, including the failure to disclose the 18 accounts, failure to pay fines and fees. Judge Bucklow's default order clearly stated that she was addressing a representative list, not an exhaustive one, of defendants' abuses, and our default judgment motion explained and documented those abuses in detail, and defendants did not dispute virtually any of them. Therefore, it is proper to consider those, and when you take the entire picture of how defendants behaved in this case, Judge Bucklow was under no obligation to continue tolerating their abuses, which even continued while our default judgment motion was pending. That's when they had fabricated Plaintiff Demonis' tax return and showed it to him at his deposition. Judge Bucklow was perfectly within her discretion to conclude that enough is enough and enter default judgment against defendants. If Your Honors have no further questions, thank you very much.
Mr. Carroll?
Thank you. So the first point I want to address is the question of the burden of proof. There's no denying that the defendants did not comply with the discovery orders concerning the bank records. And the question of the hard drive is really sort of a separate issue. They couldn't produce the hard drive itself. They made efforts to comply with the order to produce relevant emails, although, as I pointed out, a lot of emails were contained on the 21 disks that were excluded from evidence. But there are still significant burdens placed on a plaintiff at the various points in the proceeding that I indicated. When you seek contempt, for example, there is a burden on the party seeking contempt to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that the court's order has been disobeyed. And the way Judge Nolan interpreted that correctly is to say not obeyed in the general sense of was this produced, but disobeyed in the sense of did they fail to make good faith efforts to comply with the court's order. She found that they didn't, that especially Mr. Lewicki had not failed in that regard, and yet Judge Bucklow reversed that decision. Now, Mr. Lewicki, in fact, provided more than just his word as to having contacted HSBC Poland. He provided a letter with a mailing receipt, a certified mailing receipt, or the Polish equivalent of a certified mailing receipt, indicating that that he had, in fact, mailed a letter to the bank stating his account information, requesting wire transfer confirmations. And, in fact, he produced records from that bank. No one denies that. He didn't produce wire transfer confirmations, but he produced a record of account transactions on the account, which showed wire transfers. So the suggestion that he was only going on his word is incorrect. And again, we're seeking contempt here. This requires a showing by the plaintiff that something has in fact been done that was wrong. Now, concerning the order about the Bank Julius Baer account in Switzerland belonging to Adam Zweig, Judge Nolan's 1/12/12 order clearly recognizes the possibility that he will be unable to produce these records. It specifies that he should either produce the records or provide a certification of good faith efforts to comply with the court's order. This clearly recognizes that it's not simply a matter of producing the records or else. Finally, regarding the hard drive.
Oh, can we go with the Baer account for a second, Mr. Carroll?
Certainly.
Didn't Judge Nolan specifically find that there was willful violation of the discovery orders with regard to Baer?
She did, which is presumably why she entered the order that she did, the adverse jury instruction order, which it sounded until the very end like plaintiff's counsel was suggesting that an adverse jury instruction order has no place in the context of litigation. It was a proper order under those circumstances. It's considered a harsh sanction. The pension commissioner's case that he referenced, in fact, characterizes it a harsher sanction than the sanction of a daily fine. But it does balance the need for the court's orders to be followed against the possibility that a party will not be able to comply. Now, I can see that my time is up, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.